Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for The Common comes from Davis-Malm. Their tax attorneys take the time to understand your unique goals and find the most cost-effective ways to accomplish them, distilling complex tax laws down to clear choices so you can make the best decisions. DavisMalm.com, DavisMalm.com.
Hey, it's Daryl C. Murphy, and I just want to talk to you real quick. The Common is produced at WBUR in Boston. We're public media. We don't have paywalls, which means we don't ask you to pay to see our work. We say, here's some powerful stories for free. And then, if some of those stories you read or listen to are important to you and you talk about it with your friends and family, and you even see the world a little differently, then we ask you to support it. Because we want to continue making work that is meaningful to you. And right now, I want to let you know what's happening at WBUR. Our radio shows, our podcasts are getting some of the biggest audiences we've ever had. Our journalism is winning awards, reaching new and more diverse audiences. And you are a big part of that. Our journalism has never been stronger, but the business has never been harder. We've had a big loss of sponsorship dollars, like a lot of media companies have in recent years. But one thing we've always been pretty good at is getting support from our listeners to make the things they love. So we're asking right now, in a crucial moment for WBUR, can you help us get through this by joining other listeners in supporting WBUR? We need your help to keep making the podcast you're listening to right now, along with everything else that comes from WBUR. Your help would mean a lot to me and to all of my colleagues. So please, head to our website, WBUR.org. Thanks.
WBUR Podcasts, Boston.
I'm Daryl C. Murphy, and you're listening to The Common. Amelia Mason. Hello, hello, hello. Thank you for coming back to The Common.
Hey, Daryl.
So, Amelia, you are a WBUR arts and culture reporter, and that means you're with the arts desk. And you all just put out a series on the local art scene post-pandemic, right? And you wrote the first piece in the series, which focuses on theater. We're going to get into that, of course. But first, I want to know what else you guys are covering and why you're doing the series now.
Sure. So we looked at four different areas, which isn't even all the things we could have looked at, but we looked at theater, we looked at museums, dance, and then classical music. So we tried to touch as many different facets of the local sort of cultural industry, if you will, as we could. And the reason for this series really, it just started with a conversation, I think kind of like maybe January or February. A lot of these institutions had to shut down at the beginning of the pandemic. And then there was this sort of like cautious reopening phase and a lot of uncertainty for a while. And the past year or so might have been the first time where things were starting to get back to something like normal. So you had full runs of plays, you had museums open, you know, you had live performances again, basically. And at the same time, all this federal aid that had gone through that had sort of floated everybody through those first couple of years was over. So we were just wondering, like, how's everybody doing?
Yeah. And especially now, I guess, because when I say post-pandemic, you know, the pandemic is still happening, it's still going on, but
yes.
It's subsided so much, right? You know, if you didn't know any better, you would think we were back to normal, you know? So if we rewind, you know, to early 2020, right?
Yes.
Like the pandemic hits, we're all sheltering in place. Take me through the theater scene in those first few months. You know, what were they dealing with?
Right. So yes, at the very, very beginning, there was a question of like, oh, do we need to cancel shows? I don't know if you remember that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody, I think, in the theater scene had to kind of talk and like, oh, yeah, no, we really do have to cancel everything. And then it was a wait and see for a while. It was really unclear how long that would last. And once it really hit that, yeah, this is going to be a while, you know, that's when people started thinking about like how they were going to get kind of financial help to make it through. And there were federal programs that a lot of businesses could apply for that were very helpful. So, you know, in that first year or two, there was a lot of applying for grants, putting things online, tentatively scheduling performances, eventually live ones, and then sometimes canceling because people got COVID.
Okay, so that's early 2020. I guess we could say like the height of the pandemic, right? When nobody knew what the hell was going on. If we fast forward to today, what differences would I notice now?
In some ways, I think at first blush, you'd be like, cool, things are back, right? Because you have like full runs of shows happening. But if you were to look closely, or if you were me and you interviewed a whole bunch of people and they told you how many tickets they were selling, yeah, you would notice that their audiences are not all the way back. You know, approximately like a 20 to 40% dip in audience. So that's a huge difference. Mm-hmm. You'll also see audiences buying later, sort of making last minute decisions to go to a show. And that has sort of created a lot of uncertainty for theaters and anyone putting on these large productions, which are expensive. And you have to make decisions early on about, you know, how much you're investing in it and how many shows you're going to have. And then kind of waiting, you know, with white knuckles to find out if people will buy tickets. And the other big thing I think that happened, you know, theaters, some people may be familiar with this model of subscribers. These are essentially the people who buy whole seasons ahead. Those tend to be older, white subscriber bases that mm-hmm. theaters really depended on to sort of just have like the safety net, I guess, is sort of like, we can count on this amount that we'll probably sell. And it comes at the beginning of the season or before the season starts. You know, those subscriber bases were already starting to shrink. Mm. They were older and, you know, they weren't getting replenished by the younger folks when, you know, maybe they stopped buying subscriptions and that sort of thing or moved away. You know, the younger audiences were having sort of different buying habits already. And I think the pandemic really just sort of accelerated that.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
And we're back. You know, I'm thinking through from the start of 2020, 2021, 2022, like there's the phase of the pandemic where everything stopped. And then there's like the slow return, the unthawing, if you will, right?
Yeah.
Through that time and through that unthawing, there was a lot of change. And, you know, what I'm thinking about is the police murder of George Floyd and the protests that followed, right? How that moment in history just like pushed a lot of organizations to think about race and equity. So, you know, in addition to the changes that came from COVID itself, how about those more social changes, you know, where people are thinking about equity? Have you seen any of that?
Yes. I mean, it was a big one in the local theater scene and I think across the country. People who work in theater said, hey, like, you know, often these theaters sort of say a lot of nice things about wanting to have work environments that are equitable, that are racially diverse, that are sensitive. They want to put on productions that speak to many different experiences. And people mm-hmm. within the theater world were saying, this isn't always true. In fact, it's often not. So we definitely had these discussions going on internally in theater here in Boston about, you know, what does it look like to run an organization that actually sort of walks the walk a little bit, you know, and actually does what it says. So you saw definitely a lot of sort of anti-racist action plans and hold us accountable and this kind of thing. Some of the smaller organizations, it seemed to me, were able to make kind of a bigger changes and bigger pivots than the big organizations.
Yeah.
You know, for example, New Repertory Theater in Watertown. This was a theater that almost didn't make it through the pandemic. In 2021, they announced that they were pausing operations and laying off most of their staff and resetting, and the board was going to have to go figure out what to do. But when they returned, they were trying to make a very conscious effort to do things differently. So they didn't hire an executive director. I mean, they basically brought on three sort of what they call resident artists. Mm-hmm. They're sort of sharing power, this sort of different model of, you know, leadership that's supposed to be more collaborative. These are all artists of color, you know, folks who have sort of like a very vested interest in changing things in theater. Mm-hmm. You know, they're starting to ramp back up. It's early days, but I thought it was very interesting that they, in the moment of having to just stop dead, that they were like, well, let's try to do it differently, like actually differently, like structurally differently. You know, I mm-hmm. spoke to the vice chair of the board, Danielle Galligan, said, you know, in a lot of ways, this was just sort of bringing to the fore issues that were already in theater.
You know, the constant challenge, I think every theater faces this, is like, we want younger audiences, we want more diverse audiences. And you can say that till you're blue in the face, but they're not going to just come find you where you've been doing the same thing over and over and over again.
I thought that was really powerful, and also just, I think, spoke to the big takeaway for me on this reporting, which was just that the pandemic really just showed, in greater contrast, the problems that theater was already facing, which is this aging, predominantly white subscriber base that wasn't getting replenished. It isn't fixed. It just made extra super clear the problems. And I do think it sort of forced theaters to at least rethink some of the things they're doing and realize, you know, we really do have to change something.
What about labor? It felt like over the pandemic, folks got more conscious and aware of labor as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I interviewed a lot of folks who pointed out theater already underpays people, I can't say for sure if a lot of them have done really, really concrete changes, but there was definitely a lot of lip service paid to it. And again, mm-hmm. when I talked to New Rep, they did say they had instituted a $20 per hour minimum, which isn't even that high, but it's like a minimum that didn't exist before. And they talked a lot about, they don't have a lot of money, right? So they have to make these financial choices, and trying to make financial choices that put people first, to kind of deploy a cliche here, but to, you know, to really put the money into paying humans and making the work environment better. I was talking to one of their leaders, a resident artist, Michael Hisamoto. He put it this way.
Normally, if you take a look at a classical theater budget, you'll be looking at maybe $10,000 worth of lumber to build the set. But then if it's a two-person play, they're spending probably about $8,000 on the salaries for the entirety of the production for the actors. And so me looking at a spreadsheet like that, seeing actors being paid less than the wood that they're standing on, is not a model that interests me.
Mm-hmm. It was a very striking way to put it. He's not the only one who brought this issue up. And something else that people pointed out was, to get through the next few years, nonprofit theaters particularly would probably have to depend a lot more on contributed income, philanthropy, donations, maybe grants, to kind of like balance the books. And I had at least one person say, you know, maybe that's just a long-term thing. Like, if we want to prioritize paying people well and like good work environments, like maybe theater needs to rethink sort of the model thus far, where there was more reliance on sort of ticket sales, and try to bolster what you're doing with more contributed income, knowing that you kind of have to do things differently if you want to pay people well and create a good work environment.
Yeah. I do find myself, especially now, asking, were people really sincere in 2020? You know, did we really learn from the pandemic about labor and how we value people and stuff? How will these organizations, these theaters, how will they make sure that they are continuing the work that they set out to do?
Yeah, I mean, I have real concerns about it, about sort of falling back to the status quo.
So easy, right?
Yeah, it's very easy. It's probably already happening. It is already happening. Mm-hmm. It can be hard to gauge from the outside, like cultural changes within an organization. I had a leader, the leader of the Huntington Theater, say like our racial equity and anti-racist plans, like those cost money because of consultants and, you know, trainings and things. And with the financial things the way they are, you know, we'll have to take a real hard look at that, which it's not the most reassuring thing to hear. Mm-hmm. I think the big institutions have a much harder time changing on a cellular level. They've been doing things a certain way a long time. It feels very hard to shift the momentum, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Man, Amelia, this is super interesting, and I am going to check out the series, as should everybody else, right? They should just go to WBUR.org to check out the rest of this series. Amelia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me and being willing to go deep.
Hell yeah. That's WBUR arts and culture reporter Amelia Mason. And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to The Common. If you have any thoughts on this episode, give us a shout on Instagram at WBURTheCommon. You can also send us an email at thecommon@wbur.org. I'm Daryl C. Murphy, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.